and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Mangroves are a crossroad where oceans, fresh water, and land meet. They are incredibly unique and spectacular ecosystems, but of late have been increasingly vulnerable to threats such as coastal development and overexploitation. So how can we better protect and conserve our mangrove ecosystems? Well, joining us on the show today, we have Dr. Ahmad Aldri Amir. He is head of the Environmental, Economic and Social Sustainability Research Centre at UKM's Institute for Environment and Development, better known as Lestari. Dr. Aldri is also the coordinator of the Malaysian Mangrove Research Alliance and Network, My Mangrove. Dr. Aldri, thank you for joining me on the show today. Maybe we can begin our conversation by helping us understand the current condition of mangroves in Malaysia. Where do we stand in terms of ecological health? Are mangroves in Malaysia well?
Yeah, thank you very much, Melissa, for having me today. We can find mangrove all along our coastline, yeah, in Malaysia. We're so lucky. We are right smack in the middle of the tropics, and not just the tropics, in the middle of Indo West Pacific, where this is a center for species distribution, yeah, particularly for mangrove and other tropical species as well. So we can find them from Langkawi, in Perlis, and all the way to Sabah. Eh? So they are scattered all throughout our coastlines. But then in the past 100 years or so, the area declined. Yeah? Particularly beginning in the mid of last century, in which our country gained independence. And at that time, we started developing. Yeah? We started pushing for agricultural development, in which demanded for land. Yeah? So almost half, yeah, of our mangrove at that time were separated, meaning half for development and another half for protection. So that's what happened at that time. And then as the century ended, the rate of loss declined just slightly, yeah, in this new century. Okay. So, the awareness pretty much increased towards the end of last century. And it was, and we received an ultimatum actually in 2004, December 2004, when tsunami hit our coastline, yeah, or the west coast of Peninsular Malaysia. And a total change after that. So awareness increased fairly immediately at the time, and more effort were put, were given to protect our mangrove.
Well, I have to be honest with you, it was because of the tsunami that I personally learned the importance of the mangrove ecosystem. I have to say, mangroves, they're not easy to sell, because, you know, there's a lot of perception about mangroves that it's swampy, that it's dark, that it's quite a difficult, public to raise public awareness about mangroves seems to be tough because of the nature of it. How do you go about telling people why it's so important to preserve mangroves? Why it's so ecologically important to preserve mangroves?
Thank you, Melissa. Yeah, they're not as sexy as
that's right.
But then if we know them better, yeah, just like me, I'm lucky to actually fall in love with them just before tsunami, right? Because how did I fall in love with mangrove? Was simply to know all of this beauty, all of these unique characteristics of mangroves. Yeah? And I mean, imagine a terrestrial forest like what we have around us on land. Imagine that, yeah, the diversity, maybe not as much, and then the richness, the luxuriousness of forests, and add a physical characteristics, which is tides. and salt water, and being flooded every day. So this differs them with Restrephora. So that unique characteristic, that physical characteristics demanded for them to adapt to that feature. And the intelligence of these groups of plants, yeah, actually attracted me. So that to me is super sexy. So
the, this the is can you elaborate the intelligence of the plants?
Yeah, the intelligence. So I mean plants, yeah, they think, they send signals to the roots, particularly in mangrove system, in which they have they live in a very extreme condition. Soft sediment, for example, in mud, like you mentioned just now, they're muddy, right? So this negative connotation actually resulted into negative perception, in which we have to change. And this is what we are doing now. Yeah? Thank you, Melissa, for the opportunity. But yeah, living in this condition, in muddy substrate, and then in the soil, is lack of oxygen. Imagine, because water coming in and out to put pressure on the soil, so no oxygen pretty much. So they have to become smart. They have to adapt by sending signal to the bottom of the trees to build specialized root systems. Eh? So you can see prop roots in Rhizophora trees, and then you can see pencil roots like snorkels. Imagine trees doing that, right? Creating snorkels from underneath the soil to breathe, imagine. Yeah? And then not just to stabilize themselves in this soft and muddy sediment or sandy sediment, they also need to breathe. That's why, I mean, I find them very interesting, because like plant trees on land, they can absorb as much oxygen and nutrient in the soil, but they can't do that. Mangrove cannot do that. So they have to think better, yeah, and work harder, yeah, to survive. Yeah. So these are all sexy, yeah, to me.
Well, I think we have to do a better job selling it to the public, especially if we want to increase public participation in and awareness in protecting and conserving our mangroves. Can I ask you, you mentioned a bit earlier that there has been a reduction in the rate of decline. So we have taken steps to protect our mangrove ecosystems. But what does that entail? What does successful mangrove protection and conservation entail? Correct me if I'm wrong, I read somewhere that mangroves actually cannot be replanted after it's lost. So how do we protect the mangroves that we have?
Well, that depends, Melissa. So we have to understand the reason, yeah, the cause of the forest loss, and the issue, the biggest issue about restoration, yeah, restoring mangrove, is to do it right. So this is the issue commonly faced by communities, by governments all throughout the tropics. Yeah? First, we need to understand the condition of the area that we want to restore. We can actually, there are successful examples of good restoration models that we can follow, but then most of the time, yeah, I mean, it, like what happened since 2005, many restoration activity were simply planting activity, and these were all done as a result of a panic attack. Yeah. So we were hit by tsunami, and then we realized, oh, a lot of the areas affected were no longer covered or protected by mangroves. Yeah. So we simply planted, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of mangroves were being planted since 2005 in particular, yeah, all throughout the tropics. So the issue were, without knowledge, without understanding, without knowing that physical characteristics of that area, yeah, the simplest requirement for mangroves to establish and grow, that was the issue at that time. But luckily, I mean, like although still until today, there's only a few of first mangrove ecologists in the world. Yeah, we managed to influence governments, yeah, influence communities, yeah, to assist them and educate them on the best way to do it. And then, knowledge is prime, is very fundamental to know the basic requirements. Yeah?
So you say that actually there aren't that many scholars around the world who look at mangroves. Can I ask you about gaps in knowledge? I mean, do we have sufficient data, sufficient monitoring? Where are the gaps in our knowledge about mangroves? And how can we address that so that we can better design conservation programs?
Yeah, knowledge in mangroves actually the gap is wide, fairly wide. It is from as fundamental as taxonomy of it to the application of technology to restore them. So when I say basic fundamental knowledge, taxonomy in particular, we are losing taxonomies. Yeah, this is not just the issue with mangrove species, but plants and animals in general, yeah, we are losing interest or maybe losing experts. Yeah, the number is declining, and then so fundamental knowledge like botany of mangrove is very important to assist, for example, in applying restoration knowledge, and then as well as to explore the properties of mangroves, like for its medicinal use, for its if it's edible or not, yeah. So these are basic knowledge where we find a lack of expertise.
Are you, Dr. Adria, are you saying that when you refer to taxonomy of mangroves, are you saying that within a say mangrove forest or mangrove swamp, there are so many different species that we haven't yet catalogued all of the species? We don't quite understand how they all work together. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, for the higher plants, yes, we pretty much recognize most of them already, all of them already actually, because mangrove plants, yeah, they're not as diverse as terrestrial forests, so it's fairly easy to recognize them. But then even that, there are still arguments in between us scientists of categorizing or recognizing or group them as mangrove plant, because mangrove is not a taxonomic group, yeah, because and they are a combination of plants from different genus and species and family too, but then what constitute them as mangrove at the moment is that they have that characteristic that I told you earlier. They have to tolerate or to adapt to salt environment. They must be halophyte, and they must have some adaptive mechanism like creation of roots, yeah, how they filter, they exclude or they excrete salt. So these are the characteristics that they must have, and then they must have this very unique reproductive mechanism, we call it vivipary, in which mangrove, they have to let the babies grow on them. Yeah? So this is different to terrestrial plants like durian, for example. Melissa, you have to wait for the durian to drop. You break it open, eat the flesh, and then throw the seeds. Yeah,
right.
And the seeds will be germinated and grow to become new tree. But if that happens in mangrove, the babies will never have had the chance to grow, because tides come in and out. Yeah, and to take them away, so they may not have the chance. So this is another reason why they're very intelligent. So they adapt and they let the babies grow on them, and then when they are ready, they will be released, and they will straight away, looking at their design, yeah, looking at the design of the bodies, yeah, they are very slender, most of them, and they will straight away take root, yeah, nearby the parent trees. So this is a characteristic that they have. So not just intelligent, they are loving and very affectionate as well, Melissa. Yeah.
What an incredible way to look at the way nature interacts with each other. Dr. Audrey, thank you so much for being on the show. I know we can continue talking, but we'll have to continue this conversation another time. Dr. Ahmad Aldri Amir, head of the Environmental, Economic and Social Sustainability Research Centre at Lestari UKM. After this, we'll come back and take a look at some other issues with mangrove conservation, particularly its role as a tool to fight climate change. Thank you. So we'll be right back here on Consider This. Stay tuned. Hi, you're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation about the uniqueness and importance of mangrove ecosystems in particular and wetlands in general. Dr. Jarina Mohamadjani is a researcher and lecturer at the Faculty of Science and Marine Environment at University Malaysia Terengganu. Dr. Jarina, can we talk a little bit about some of the interaction between nature and society? And I think that I'm wondering whether there is kind of public awareness, public consciousness about our role in our interaction with nature, particularly in something in the uniqueness of wetlands, for instance, where I think a lot of us don't really understand the importance of wetlands to not just the ecology, but to the entire biosphere. So how can we better understand the importance of something as unique as the wetlands?
Cool. Hi, Mel. Thank you for having me. So I think it's, I must say in general, I would say that there is definitely public awareness campaigns and efforts in Malaysia. But of course, biased I am as a human ecologist, I think that sometimes what we lack is basically a certain emphasis on the local context, meaning that my interest is actually how people relate to nature. And I believe that mangrove and all wetlands, especially like the ones I work with, like behind here, we have a kerchot swamp, which is actually Lapironia articulata, a very interesting aquatic plant that you guys have to come and see in situ. And so the thing is, you have to, for me, if you want to do public engagement about a certain landscape or ecosystem, you have to understand what it means to the people that live in the area or who you want to engage with. So I can only speak mostly from our experience working in city wetlands, where we've been successful with community to actually get this area gazetted by the state in 2018, because we were able to emphasize on the fact that city wetlands, especially the mangrove and all the other wetlands, there are 10 different kinds of wetlands here, by the way, that it's worth protecting, not just because it's a biodiversity hub, not just because it's important for the environment, but it's important for people. Because what is interesting about city wetlands is that when you come here, you really see how these ecosystems benefit people for their livelihood and everything. So that is very important. And this is not just because they are rural folks and they need to get natural resources from these ecosystems, but it's relevant as well to even people in the urban areas. For example, where you have a patch of mangrove or a certain wetlands, you have to engage with them and ask them and understand, what does this mean? For example, if you look at Titiwangsa, it's a wetland. It's an artificial, of course, lake, but now it's been there for a long time. And it is actually under threat in a sense, because it's like it's smack in the city. And unless we get people to really embrace that as their wetlands and want more, enrich it, and because it's a place where people can have so much values, ecosystem values, then you lose, because you're not relating, you're not making that part of their world theirs, in a sense.
So that's where we have to improve. Can I ask you about that interaction between nature and society? I would have thought that human activity would be one of the biggest stressors to wetlands, and you would want to keep humans, you want to keep humans away from these precious ecological heritage sites. How do we ensure that there is a balance in the interaction, that we're not kind of keeping humans from enjoying nature, yet at the same time not destroying nature through our activities?
Okay, first of all, this probably comes from me because I'm an incorrigible optimist and I'm a people person. I love nature, but I'm a people person. I believe in people first. And I think if you follow literature, I mean, it's true. When the world started trying to protect nature, all these movements in the US and everything, wilderness, they always thought that people were the problem. We have to take them out from pristine areas. But there's no such thing as pristine, actually. Probably some parts of Antarctica, but the rest of the world, no, we've been here. It's a social ecological system. So we have to think that it's part of us. And especially because we are human beings, who can we better talk to, convince, than our own species? I mean, the fact that and it's been shown, and now I think if you look at existing management approaches all over the world, which are more advanced, they understand now that we have to bring people back. Because we care about something, because it means to us. you know, even reintroduction of species, if you remember, not just humans, there were certain animals that were taken out from certain landscapes because they thought they were destroying the ecosystem, like the wolves. They were totally decimated. But now, like in Yellowstone, it was the reintroduction of the wolves that actually improved things. And it's the same thing with people. It's just that we have to, for this, the problem is when we took people out, we created tension. We did not understand that we always saw people as potential threat. We did not want to understand that they are actually people who actually managed. Can you imagine now people only realizing that the American landscape, for example, has never been pristine? It was actually basically, the American Indians were tendering the wild. You know, it's not a wild landscape as John Muir thought, but it's actually it's this landscape by people. It's just that because we've been here so long. So I believe, for me, taking people out from the ecosystem equation is a plan to fail. We have to bring them back. But of course, that's where, even for traditional knowledge, for me, I think that's another problem when people say, oh, we have to use the indigenous people, whatnot, because they know more. We have to also remember that the knowledge of tradition, from tradition, which is traditional ecological knowledge that people gain from being in the area for a long time, also has to be improved, also have to be upgraded, because that has been from the observation they made by their generation and generations, but there will be gaps. And it's not always relevant. It's the same as science. It has always have to be updated. And by bringing them as part of the discussion, even between scientists and local resource users, for example, we improve the practice. So that's how we remain sustainable, in my opinion.
Can I ask you about those gaps in knowledge? Because it relates to why you are in Seti, why you're working with the Seti wetlands to understand it better. In your line of work, where are the gaps in knowledge? What is the biggest challenge for you when you're trying to, in your line of work, in your line of research, where are the gaps? And I'm just wondering whether there are still a lot of unknowns in our own backyard.
First of all, I'll answer the last question. There's so much unknown. That's why some people find me so funny, because how can you research, Jarina, in the same area for more than 10 years? I've been there since 2006, and I'm still so passionate about it because I learn every day. Yes, there's still so much to know. But talking about the gap, let me talk about the two, because I'm basically trying to be a bridge, I guess. Because for the longest time in Malaysia, we have been more heavy. If you want to, which is great when we can inform policy, but policy have been quite heavy on the pure sciences in a sense, natural science and whatnot. So social science has been not really, I'm probably one of the few human ecologists in Malaysia. But so I'm trying to, building the bridge, for me, the gap has been that bridge. Because from the local people perspective, for example, from our research, we have been able to show that they know so much and their practice is actually sustainable, especially in certain areas where there's less industrial threat and whatnot. So it is sustainable. It's just that they never tell people that we are sustainable, you know, because we have this in Malaysia, there's always been this different strata of, governance. So they're just small people. So they don't take pride in the fact that what they're doing is actually helping the world. They don't say that. And the problem is because we're so, for the longest time, we've been techno-driven, agency-driven, agencies as well, even in academia, I must be honest, do not consider them as knowledge holders. So this has been the gap. For me, it's actually, so I really don't like the word of knowledge transfer because it's so condescending. There's so many people, oh, let's do knowledge transfer with the community. We tell them what is actually state of knowledge. No, I say it's knowledge sharing. We have something to share with them, but they have so much to tell us because, for example, how much money can you have to do sampling every day? Because you can't, you have limited resources. But these people, because of their livelihood, they see what happens in the field every single day. They actually observe changes more often than we do. It's just that they don't record, they don't table, they don't do that. So if we are able to collect information from them and also capture their understanding and their interpretation of these changes, it will make us the knowledge more rich. So that's the bridge that I'm trying to build, I guess, the gap, because that's the gap. From one side, understand that each has value, that the local community has to have more pride in what they do and what they know, and academia as well, knowing that these are my potential partners, not just people that I need to teach.
Right. Dr. Jarina, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Dr. Jarina Mohd Jani from University of Malaysia, Terengganu, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.
Thank you.